Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Sion Bailak on the podcast. Sion began her tenure as Barnard College president in July 2017 after spending 12 years at the University of Chicago, where she served on the faculty as the Stella M. Rowley Professor of Psychology, Executive Vice Provost, and an officer of the university. Her work as a cognitive scientist revolves around performance anxiety and reveals simple psychological strategies that can be used to ensure success in everything from test taking and public speaking to athletics and job interviews. In 2010, she wrote the critically acclaimed book, Choke, and in 2015, she wrote How the Body Knows Its Mind. In 2017, she won the Trolland Award from the National Academy of Sciences, and her recent TED Talk has been viewed more than 2 million times. Sion, so great to finally chat with you today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So I thought we'd start talking a little about your very interesting career journey. Serious academic. You're still a serious academic, but...
I'm still a serious
academic. But kind of like serious academic exclusively, you know, to college president. This is incredible, you know, this journey. Can you talk about how that transformation happened?
It's interesting because it wasn't planned in any way, shape, or form. And really, as an assistant professor, even associate professor at the University of Chicago, I so focused on my lab and my department. I'm not even sure I could have said what division my department was in at the college. But it was shortly after I got tenure that I was I got voted onto our faculty senate, and then a smaller group of individuals, it was 12 people, who had lunch with the president and provost every 2 weeks, 12 faculty at Chicago, and really advised them and talked about the university. And it was the first time that I really realized there was this whole institution out there, and that it wasn't just a researcher, a faculty member, or a lab. It was all of those things operating within an institution. And I kind of fell in love with this idea that you could affect change at a higher level, and that you could help raise the voices of so many smart, interesting people inside. And that's when I became interested in administration. And from there, I stepped into a vice provost role at Chicago, and then executive vice provost, and then the presidency at Barnard.
It does seem like even in your early research, you really always had this interest in practical application and the real world.
Yeah. I mean, and I always thought it was never either or, that you could publish in serious academic journals and also ask questions about aspects of performance that people cared about. But I will say that I think it's becoming more and more acceptable in academia. But when I went up from tenure, I actually didn't put on my dossier that I had a book contract. And my chair at the time came back to me and said, I want some way to talk about all of the sort of public speaking you've done and the practical applications of your work. And I said, well, actually, I have this book contract to write a popular audience book for Simon & Schuster. And he was like, well, of course we have to talk about this. This is really important. And I really credit a senior colleague for sort of normalizing it for me, because I think that was a special thing to happen at Chicago, and I'm not sure that would have happened everywhere.
When I was in grad school, I remember telling people, I want to write a book someday. People were like, yeah, you're going to have to wait 40 years to get tenure, and then you get tenure plus, and then you get whatever.
I think it does a disservice to the field to put this juxtaposition in. I mean, if we're not writing about the work that's happening in science, someone else is going to. And it doesn't mean that everyone has to do it, but you know, the work that you do, Scott, and so many other sort of people that cross over, I think is so important. I mean, we have the tools and the knowledge to interpret what's happening in science, and frankly, I think it's some of our responsibility to do so.
Yeah, I've always thought that was the case, you know, that part of our responsibility, and it surprised me that academics didn't. I mean, my mentor in undergraduate, Herb Simon, very straight-laced, serious, rigorous, you know, decision-making. You know what I mean? That seems straight. It seems straight-laced for some reason, doesn't it? It's decision-making, you know, information processing. He told me, he gave me advice when he said, you know, a good scientist really sticks to the science, you know, really just does pure science, leave the rest to someone else. And I was just like, inside, yeah, I was this little, like, you know, 19-year-old, but I was like, yeah, I'm not sure about that inside. I didn't challenge him, but he is an amazing, I mean, he won the Nobel Prize, so there is something to be, I didn't win the Nobel Prize yet, so maybe he did have a point.
Yeah,
so.
I think that it exemplifies that there's different ways to be a good scientist, yeah, is what I would say.
So your first book was about choking under pressure.
Yeah.
Is there a personal reason why you got interested in that topic at all? Did you have like anxiety in school as a kid or something of that sort?
Yeah, I always talk, this is another sort of coming back to what you are and aren't supposed to do as a scientist. I always talk about the fact that there's a lot of me-search in this. It's not just research. And I think I also heard that as a scientist, like you're supposed to separate yourself from the work that you're doing. And that's the only way to be objective. But I think it's okay for you to have interest in the kind of work that you're doing as a scientist. And I think it provides a passion that can propel people. And so I was, as an undergraduate, I was a cognitive science major at UC San Diego, which I was just absolutely in love with the whole program. And I remember we read so many interesting articles and books about people operating at high levels, like how learning occurs. You know, we read stuff by Herb Simon and others about what it takes to be a really great performer, what happens in the brain as you learn and acquire skills. And there just wasn't that much that I was reading about what happens when you fail, right? And especially when you are at a high skill level. And I was an athlete growing up. I played soccer at a pretty high level. And I always was wondered why sometimes I didn't perform as well as I could in those situations where there was a lot on the line. And it seemed counterintuitive to me because I wanted to perform really well. And so there was a really element for me of trying to understand what happened in high pressure situations and whether or not there were tools that we all could use to perform better.
I was wondering, is there a continuum, like is flow on the opposite end of choking? Can you be in flow and still choke? You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, I think it depends on how, like what you define as flow. I think in some sense you could talk about a continuum if you define flow as performing at an optimal level, like with ease, right? And so choking could be on the other end of that. You know, one thing I think is really interesting is that when people talk about flow, they talk about this characteristic of being like not over attentive or not focusing on the details of what you're doing, and sometimes not even having a memory for what you've done. And you know, we, in my work and others, we've shown that when one of the reasons people can choke under pressure is they actually pay too much attention to aspects of their skills that should just be on autopilot. So I think there are some ways to put it on a continuum.
Yeah, because whenever I think of the opposite of choking, I just keep thinking of like Michael Jordan. I keep thinking of like, you know, when they're on the court and they're like, they have these deadly instincts, you know, where they're just like, they're so in the zone and so... But they still miss shots. And something that's interesting to me is that is some of this framing as well. Could some of the things we do, we say, oh, I totally choked in that situation. Whereas someone else may have the same exact situation and be like, oh, well, you know, just went off. The ball just went off like a couple inches to the right. You know, next time I know what I'm going to do. And they don't even think about it in like that way. You know what I mean? Is there an individual differences in just like even framing of the situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting. And there is this individual difference in what we even consider pressure situations, right? Yeah. Like, so if I have to give a talk, and my mom likes to sometimes come to my talks wherever I am, and she makes me so nervous, right? But my mom's probably not going to make you nervous. Even how you interpret the situation can be different. And what one person finds to be a pressure situation, another person might not. And I think what you're talking about framing is also how we react to a situation. I mean, we all have performance ups and downs. I wouldn't call that choking. When I talk about choking, I'm talking about a situation where you feel pressure to perform at a high level, you want to perform at a high level, and then you perform worse than expected given your skill level. I think framing it as, you know, this is what happened poorly, whether it's luck or technique, and here's what I'm going to do differently next time, we actually know is one way to prevent choking moving forward. Thinking about how you're going to control the situation next time or how you're going to succeed rather than dwelling on the failure.
Because it's just fascinating to me. Like, I watch some of these high-level sports performers, and they miss a lot of shots. I mean, they miss a lot of they keep, you know, but they just keep going back, and then over the long run they tend to have more, you know, they think in the terms of the bigger picture, in terms of
Yeah, and I think that's actually really important. And not, it's not the more you can take sort of your identity and your feelings of success out of one individual instance, you know, the more you might be buffered from feeling nervous about that instance. And I will say that, you know, you mentioned Michael Jordan, who was an amazing basketball player, but I think he's a really great example of how being successful in one thing doesn't mean you're inoculated from choking in others. I mean, he had a real hard time hitting a baseball, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's important to keep in mind.
Okay, so I was wondering how this relates to your research on women's career success.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I'm so excited to be at Barnard, which is, I'm now in my fourth year, which is like unbelievable. I have been really interested in situations where people might be worried about their ability to perform because of historically held stereotypes, or because they're worried about being evaluated based on who they are. You know, I've had an interest in math and science, and especially for women and girls. And some of my research has looked very early, showing that young girls can pick up on anxiety about their ability to perform in math and science based on their teachers and their parents, and that carries out into success even later in life. So I think, you know, there's a very clear relationship for me.
Parents' sort of feedback and responses to, so what, do you have specific examples?
Yeah, so we've shown, for example, that when, if you look across, for example, college majors, do you know what the college major with the most math anxiety is? Do you have a guess?
It's not math. It's not a math major.
Okay,
let me guess. So it's like a major where they have the math component to it. Is that right?
No, if you survey college majors,
okay,
like about how anxious they are about math.
Oh, okay. So
what's the major with the most?
I guess I'm
going to
be
anxiety.
Just like stereotype, and I'll just go for like music.
Yeah. Well, it turns out it's education.
Oh. Yeah, interesting.
Which is highly women-dominated,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, and so we've actually shown that like over 90% of first and second grade teachers, for example, in the U.S. are women, and they have very high levels of math anxiety. And we've shown that when students are in classes with teachers who are high in math anxiety, by the end of the school year, they learn less math, and they're also more likely to be anxious about their own ability.
That's really interesting. I probably should have thought that through. I literally just choked on your the question that you asked me, because why would someone who's a math major have math anxiety? That didn't even make any sense. I didn't really think that through. See, I was like nervous.
It just goes to show we all choke.
Yeah, I literally,
you know, in so many situations.
I just colossally choked on your question. Okay, but yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense now. I think this through, and yeah, education doesn't have high math requirements, right? I don't even think statistics.
Interesting, when our first article came out, I got some emails from math professors at different universities saying that there'd been a lot of pressure from their administrators to actually reduce the math requirements for education majors because they thought that would help, and they were probably right, attract undergrads to the institution, right? If you were looking for an education major with less math. And so it's a really interesting, I thought that was quite interesting in that how, you know, policy or thinking about an entity at such a high level, like how many undergrads you can enroll at a university, has implications for who we're training in terms of who's teaching.
For sure. And a lot of this translates into representation in the STEM fields, right? And, you know, ultimately, educators are not trying to be represented in the STEM fields. Is it necessarily a bad thing that the educators are afraid of like maybe math majors are afraid of education, you know, like, you know, if we think about this, zoom out for a second, is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, I do think that if we have young, or if we have teachers who are focused mostly on elementary school who are worried about math, what we're doing is we are potentially hurting a population of students who would go on and succeed in those areas. I mean, remember, an elementary school teacher is not specializing. And actually, what you find is in a lot of more wealthy schools, they often have math specialists, right? Mm-hmm. So now we start getting into achievement gaps where people in wealthier school districts have accessed students to additional math teaching or help, where they're getting different inputs. And I think it's a serious and scary problem, because you could imagine a student, and especially female students year over year, who are getting compounding input about whether, you know, they are a math person or not, which we know is not a thing, and also whether or not they can succeed in it. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's bad for society if our goal is to put as many people as possible at the table to succeed in areas that they have potential in.
It seems like the Matthew effects concept is relevant here, you know, that the rich get richer, poor get poorer idea, and a little small little changes and really compound. If you're just slightly taller and you get picked for the basketball team when you're young, you get picked, you're more likely to get picked for the next one, more likely to get, and it just compounds. And then we say, you're so talented, you know, 10 years later, you know, to the person.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it seems like these things certainly can compound. And I've written articles as well on why is there such underrepresentation of men in the caring professions, you know, trying to understand. There's some actually really cool research trying to examine that as well, and just try to understand all the different ways that we have these stereotypes in our society that are limiting the full potential of all humans. And I really like the work you're doing, and I think it's really important.
Thank you.
So what advice do you have for listeners then who are early in their careers? Maybe if it's a women listeners particularly interested in this conversation, they don't feel particularly confident about certain abilities, but they clearly have the abilities, you know, what do you say?
I mean, first of all, I would say that something that, and I think this is particularly true for women, and there's research that shows this, is that it's okay to feel uncomfortable in a situation, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that women are less likely to apply for a job if they don't have all the criteria compared to men, or if they get a B in a class, are less likely to predict they can go on to the next level of the class relative to men. And I think something we talk a lot about at Barnard is sort of, it's being uncomfortable and taking that extra step, and even being okay not succeeding, right? Or not succeeding the first time around.
Yeah.
And so I would say, you know, that it's really important to try and push yourself into those situations where you don't have it already all figured out, and where you might not have 100% confidence in your abilities.
Sorry.
The goal is to get some help and to ask questions and ask around. And I think that's also a place where there sometimes can be gender differences in sort of the ability to ask for help in certain situations, or the ability to think you have to do it all on your own.
I suffered from terrible test anxiety as a kid. I wish I could have asked you this next question when I was, you know, in senior in high school. But, you know, what's a way that you can prepare yourself mentally for a high stakes situation, whether it's a big presentation, job interview, athletic event, major test, or interviewing a college president on a podcast?
I mean, the biggest technique, I think the most important one, is to practice under the kinds of conditions you're going to perform under. So I would say, like, you know, all your times interviewing really important people, more important than me, has gotten you ready for this. And I think it's something that is true in so many different areas. Like, you know, what's the biggest predictor of how well you do on standardized tests? One of them is how many times you've taken the test before, right? Mm-hmm. Or tests like it. And in athletics, you know, we often practice free throws or penalty kicks when no one's watching, but that's not how you take them. So the goal is to create situations as close as possible that mimic what's going to happen in the real do or die. And it doesn't mean you have to practice in front of a crowd, but if you're going to give a talk or a presentation in class, are you practicing in front of other people? Are you getting used to those feelings of, you know, dread that you might feel? Even if no one's watching, can you videotape yourself? Mm-hmm. How do you mimic the kinds of conditions you're going to feel in the real moment?
That's really good advice. So let's just talk about Barnard a little bit. Why do you think Barnard College is unique in the academic, even compared to like Columbia?
I mean, I think Barnard is singular. There's no place like it in the country or the world. It's an institution focused on empowering young women. And it does this in this small, tight-knit environment, but with the larger resources of this major university. So you have, I think, the best of both worlds. And I think really what makes it so special are the faculty. You know, our faculty as you know, are all tenured at Barnard and Columbia, but they're so devoted to working with students and being part of the research. And
we've adjuncts too.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's just, it makes for this really compelling atmosphere. And you combine that with a focus, a real explicit focus on bringing voices that are sometimes marginalized to the table. And I think it sets students up to have a voice. And I'm sure you've seen that.
Big time.
In terms of the students. I mean, they come out really special. I'm a little biased. I have to say I'm biased, but I really do believe
that. No, I think they're amazing. I really do. A big part of the course I taught there, the Science of Living Well, is self-actualization and you know, helping any student, whatever they want to do in their lives, to really help them like focus on their values and clarify their values, clarify their vision. Some of these students' visions are just remarkable. I would say a lot of the students' visions are remarkable, you know, how they want to like completely change the world, you know, for the better.
Yeah.
It's heartwarming.
Yeah. I mean, I think our students really give me hope, and we do. We talk about that a lot, how we're setting Barnard women up to go out and change the world. And there's lots of examples how our graduates have done that.
Yeah.
And I can't think of a more important thing to be doing right now.
So do you teach a freshman seminar?
I don't. I haven't yet. What I do is for our first years under normal years during orientation, we have a program called Barnard Reads, where many faculty do a seminar. It's a one-time seminar with students. So I usually have about 100 students, and we read one of my papers, actually written with a graduate student who went to Barnard, a former graduate student. But I haven't, you know, my first several years, I've just been so busy. But I give guest lectures and do other things, and I feel like I get some chances to interact with the students then.
So if you did teach a full freshman seminar, what would like your ultimate topic be?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I think it would, maybe not so surprisingly, you know, the psychology of human performance. And I think it's something that, you know, we're all inherently interested in. I mean, we all have times where we don't perform up to our potential. And we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, how you learn and what tools you need to be successful, but we don't spend as much time talking about the mental aspects of this. You know, what are the tips and tools in the moment you can use to pull off your best performance? And what do you do if you've failed? And that's really why I wrote Choke, you know, to give people sort of a toolbox of techniques that are research-based that can drive and help our best performance.
Would you ever guest lecture in my class on this topic?
Yes, I would love to. You haven't asked me yet.
I can't believe it. I'm just like realizing right now. I'm like, I try to like, I don't want to like bother you, but I'm just like,
no,
thinking,
I'd be happy.
Yeah,
to.
Yeah. I'm just thinking like, wow, like the students would really amazingly benefit from that.
Actually, have gone in a couple times in Dina Mayer's OChem class, and I give them study tips because, you know, organic chemistry, I think many of us experienced, was a really difficult class. One of the things that I guess you touched on earlier is, you know, oftentimes people walk out of a class or a test and they're like, oh my God, I choked. Mm-hmm. And it could very well be they choked, or it could be that they actually didn't know the material and didn't know they didn't know. And like, our ability to understand what we know, which we often talk about as metacognition, is not always great and not always correlated with accuracy. So part of what I talked about with the students were taking practice tests, getting in study groups, and, you know, figuring out ways to assess what you know before you have to perform.
You're really helpful advice for me as well. So thank you. This is really great. So are you seeing a increase in political activism on the campus right now? I mean, it was already pretty high, a lot of activists on campus, but are you seeing an increase in this cultural moment we're having with a reckoning of race tensions in America?
I mean, there's no question that I think college campuses are a really important place to have these conversations. And I think, as you know, we're one of the only institutions that really made a intentional focus on the curriculum around these issues. So for all first years this year, are taking a new course called Big Problems, Making Sense of 2020, where we have activists and others in giving lectures on what they're doing in this environment, and students are in groups talking about it. And we also have a new co-curricular program called Third Space, where students are getting to learn from activists and practitioners in their own hometowns about what they're doing to affect change. And I think where colleges and universities can help and support students into funneling their interest and their distress into to ways to affect change is where we can be really important, where we can have a real important impact.
Do you see, as part of that curriculum, do you see a discussion at all how much one should bring in science, you know, into the work to make sure their activism is grounded on a very firm basis of reality?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I hope those discussions are going on. I think, you know, there's a lot of a discussion about how we interpret the news media and how the news media interprets the data and how important it is for students to be good consumers of that information. Barnard is one of the few schools where everyone has a statistics requirement or an requirement where they have to take a class where they have to think empirically. And I think that's so important. I mean, just through the whole COVID pandemic and through the racial unrest that we've seen recently, I'm just always so amazed how easy it is to present data that I don't think as a reader reflects actuality, right?
I mean, I agree.
You know, with numbers of COVID cases, when, you know, you talk about things going up 500%, it matters what the baseline is.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it just seems like it's such a good kismet for aspiring activists to also learn about statistics, you know, for instance, or to learn about, so they can be good consumers, like you said, of information and make sure their activism's on a solid basis. So yeah, I think that the two aren't incompatible.
At all. I mean, yeah. And I talk, you know, I often, when I talk about Barnard, I talk about getting an education across the arts and sciences. There's not this either or. I think the liberal arts is a term that from research we know that people don't even understand what it means. And I think an education across the arts and sciences is what we're providing our students. You know, we're teaching, I talk a lot about how we're teaching them how to think, not what to think. You know, I think it's so important to have different political views represented on campus and in the classroom. And I think students should feel uncomfortable in challenging their own views, especially in the classroom.
But ultimately, you know, make it known that it's a safe space to challenge the views. You know, like you can do so and not be condemned if people disagree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I feel like the word safe space, it's like, again,
it's triggering
like one of
to some people.
It's and it doesn't mean the same thing to everyone. Right.
And yeah.
And I do think there are spaces, and certainly spaces on college campuses, where people should feel free to get together with people who have the same lived experiences, who look like them, who believe what they believe. I mean, that's an important aspect of living, right? To be around people who you feel really unguarded with. But I don't actually see that being what should happen in the classroom. And I think, you know, you should be challenged, of course. You should be challenged in a way where you're free to give your point of view and you don't feel condemned for it. But I think it's okay to feel uncomfortable in lots of situations. And it's not something we always like, but it leads to better thinking and better ideas.
I agree with that very much. Yeah. So let's just briefly just touch on How the Body Knows Its Mind, your more recent book, The Surprising Power of the Physical Environment to Influence How You Think, Feel. Don't you love these titles?
Yeah.
the Shocking Truth. You know, it's like, let's talk about body language. That's very, very interesting to me. How can gestures help us learn?
No, I think, you know, the whole premise of that book was that our thinking and our ability to function in the environment isn't just something that happens in our head. Our environment matters. I think we all experience this in different ways, especially when we've been cooped up. Like being able to look out in nature or be outside or take a break can affect our well-being and our mental health, and it can affect how we think. And just as our environment matters, so does our body. And so this idea that we can use our fingers and our body to index, to help hold information, you know, people don't talk about a lot, but it's actually true. Like this idea that kids counting on their fingers, that's an important way to offload mental demands, right? Cognitive effort. And at some point you want to get away from that. But this idea that you start on your fingers is totally fine. Or, you know, for me, the way I remember things is to have lots of little piles in my office of the things I'm working on. I definitely think that's an external memory aid that I use to remind myself of what is happening. Mm. And it's powerful to use the body in this way.
Yeah. And there's the whole sense of movement right now. Do you have any advice for people who are just so sedentary?
Yeah. I mean, it's advice that I need to take myself, but I think we have to really force ourselves to get up and away from our screens. You know, all those little places where we would move to go down to the lunchroom or to walk to work or wherever, like, if those are not available to us, we have to really do things to keep it up. Because it's so easy to just not leave your house or to not get up and move around. And we know that an active body is so important for physical health and mental health.
Green scenery.
Yeah, and there's some great work by a former colleague of mine at the University of Chicago that really shows that being out in nature can change how we think and our ability to attend, and even looking out in nature. And I've heard from so many people during the pandemic that they're really cognizant of being able to go outside and when they can and how much they appreciate it. And those little things matter.
And then how can you use the Alexander technique to eliminate physical tension?
Yeah, I think just this idea that we have to really be aware of our body, how we're moving it, how we sit. Stretching is so important. Anything that helps us really sort of release the tension that we have everywhere can be so important for success.
Do you want to like go into like a couple minute, like an exercise for our listeners? I don't know. Do you want to do that? I know you have a link here at alexandertechnique.com. We could just direct them to that webpage.
Yeah, I think it's like anything from body-centered meditation to, you know, getting out and moving. Like, I think these are all things that as we maybe have a little more time on our hands, maybe some of us don't, but they're really important to look into.
You even suggest taking an acting class?
Yeah, as a way to get used to being uncomfortable, right? Yeah. Getting used to embodying different people. I think all of these things can be really great for reducing stress. I mean, just like you read a good book or watch a TV show to sort of take that step and lose yourself, having a class like that, you know, can help you step away.
Well, do you have any final tips or anything you want to say that we didn't cover?
I will just say that, you know, how we move and how we think about our situations really matter. And so we often tend to just discard our mental states, right? But there's a lot of psychological research out there showing how important it is that we attend to them as well. And there are things that we can do to feel better, even in this crazy and often horrible time where we don't feel like we have control over anything. We can control some of what we're doing, whether we step outside, get up and move, how we think about the future as something that we can conquer or something that's filled with dread. Like, our mindset really matters.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Sian. A lot of people are going to really find this episode helpful for them. And I really appreciate you coming on the Psychology Podcast.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes and subscribe to the Psychology Podcast YouTube channel, as we're really trying to increase our viewership on YouTube. In fact, many of these episodes are in video format on YouTube, so you'll definitely want to check out that channel. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.